The death of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police started protests around the U.S. We are going to have a conversation about equality and injustice. Joining me are Samuel Starks, Executive Director, MLK 365, UC Davis Professor Bruce Haynes, and Professor Christopher Towler of Sacramento State. Professor Haynes, in response to Black Lives Matter, we sometimes hear the phrase, all lives matter. Those that make the statement say it's well-intended because all human life should matter. Tell us, though, why is the statement so negatively received by the Black community?
Well, I think it was a rhetorical rejection of Black Lives Matter in some ways, and their claim to draw attention to police brutality. So to argue that all lives matter is a way to sort of rhetorically sidestep the issue, I guess.
And Sam, you and I have talked about this many times. What is it that folks who make the statement, from your perspective, what are they missing?
That the people who make the statement that all lives matter, or the people who make the statement that Black Lives Matter?
The people that make the statement that all lives matter.
Well, I think to Bruce's point, it's certainly a kind of either it's a gross misunderstanding, or, you know, oftentimes, because how many times can you explain that, of what it means? It comes across oftentimes as a more of the rhetorical rejection of an affirmation that's desperately needed. And one could say all lives matter aspirationally, but you can't say all lives matter in fact, because based on law, based on action, based on 250 some odd years, all lives don't matter, and all lives will not matter until Black lives matter. And so this is this kind of back and forth, you know. And if I could, I think these are teaching moments for all. I don't think whether you say all lives matter or Black Lives Matter should be this kind of a test of whether you're down for the people, or whether you can, you know, go to the picnic or whatever you want to go. But it should be oftentimes a way for us to kind of gauge and then look at someone. Dr. King would always say, you know, you almost in the Avatar kind of way, I see you, that you really look into that person and see what their heart is saying, instead of kind of, you know, rejecting them on face because of what they say. It really is something that it takes learning and teaching, but there's that whole back and forth of the rhetorical rejection.
Professor Towler, when Sam just says Martin Luther King's words were, I see you, what is it that the people that are protesting, what is it that they're trying to make sure is seen?
Right now, I think the people that are out in the streets are absolutely trying to make sure that the Black lives that are taken at a disproportionate rate in this country, we see them taken by police, we see them taken through our healthcare system, we see them taken in a number of ways, that those Black lives are seen and recognized. And I think this speaks to the discussion we're already having around All Lives Matter, and that the call for All Lives Matter in response to Black Lives Matter really does sort of push aside all of the historical evidence that Black lives have disproportionately been taken, and Black people have lost their lives at a disproportionate rate in this country for a various number of reasons. And, you know, we've also started to see more of a call for all Black Lives Matter within the Black Lives Matter campaigns, suggesting that there's even inequities within the Black community that need to be dissected. And there are rates of life expectancy that vary depending on gender identity or non-gender conforming identity within the Black community that are being interrogated within the Black Lives Matter movement itself. And so these are very complex and intricate systems and movements that we're talking about. And really the claim for All Lives Matter really downplays this call to identify these disproportionalities within American society.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I want to follow up. Can I add to that?
Sure, come on.
Well, you know, as I was listening to Professor Tyler speak, it reminded me of, you know, when Dr. King was marching back in 68, right before his death, and the garbage strikers that he was helping to organize were wearing big placards that said, "I am a man." And in many, many ways, this call to recognize Black lives is exactly the same statement. It's saying, recognize my humanity, precisely because the way in which we are treated by many of our institutions does not recognize our humanity.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about recognizing humanity and the moment, and I believe that that in that garbage strike, they were holding signs saying, "I am a man, recognize my humanity." Right now, these are the biggest set of mass demonstrations in the United States since the civil rights movement. What has happened at this moment that's brought us to this extraordinary explosion of activism that's taking place, not only throughout this country, but in cities across the world? And Professor Haynes, I'm looking at you, so.
Oh, you're looking at me? Well, there are two things that jump into my mind. First is, not since Wilson at the turn of the century have we had such an explicitly racist president. The second thing is the ability for us to watch, almost as it's happening, Black men being gunned down, in this case with Mr. Floyd, in this case being snuffed out in public in a way that seems so unbelievably callous, when you have a crowd standing pleading with the police to recognize this man is about to die, and the ability for them to kind of just tune out, it seems, the crowd, Mr. Floyd. I think this forced us to recognize that maybe this has been going on a lot more than we choose to acknowledge. And that, you know, I was listening to some songs yesterday, soul, R&B, and reggae, and I was shocked by how many references there were to Black lives dying, and references to mothers, you know, no woman, no cry, you know, this notion that this is a narrative of our community in America, this violence.
Professor Tyler, I'd ask you the same question. This phenomenon, I think, has taken many of us, at least in terms of its depth and breadth, by complete surprise. When you look at this and place it in a historical context, what does it say to you?
Well, when I start almost every one of my political science classes, I push my students to interrogate the conflict within American politics and society between these ideas of individual liberty and social equality. They're two values that we as Americans hold dearly to our hearts, but they really are conflictual in nature. And over American history, as I've studied social movements, we see movements that take generations to arise to push back on a strong, powerful sense of individual liberty to really make America a more democratic country in the sense of expanding social equality. And I think the civil rights movement, the massiveness of it, was really a response to the failures of Reconstruction. And what we're seeing today, almost 50, 60 years later, is really a response to the failures of the civil rights movement, really the second Reconstruction, that focused on addressing the overt racism and segregation of the Jim Crow era and pushed for an expansion of voting rights, but failed to address the systemic inequalities when it comes to things such as economics, such as healthcare, such as wealth. And we recently saw in 2013 a dramatic rollback of voting rights as well, with the Shelby v. Holder Supreme Court decision eliminating the Attorney General oversight in the Voting Rights Act. And all of this, to me, is really just a culmination of those failures building and building over time, set off again, as Professor just said, by a very racist authoritarian regime that does not care for Black lives whatsoever and has made that very clear.
Sam, the last time there were that many people as there have been over the past few days in downtown Sacramento, was Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday and the MLK March that you run every year. And full disclosure, folks, I'm the chairman of that board, that draws over 30,000 people to downtown. Mm-hmm. Years ago, people were scared, the powers that be were scared about even having that many people, particularly African-American people in downtown Sacramento. But that experience of that day, and I was there, and the experience of the last few days, it's almost like we're living in two different dimensions of reality. How do you reconcile that?
Well, initially what we have been living comfortably with the normal. We have come to peace with the normal. And that normal has taken Black lives. That normal means on a day, we talk about Black Lives Matter when oftentimes it's associated with Black death, associated with police. But America indeed is a institution-based society. And those institutions perpetuate ideas and values and actions and outcomes throughout our history and time. And so when you look at education, you have to also say Black Lives Matter. When you look at bank loans, when you go to get a loan for a home and you're denied, you have to say Black Lives Matter. It's not necessarily at the point of a gun that Black life is taken. And so over that period of time, we have come to grips and we have become somewhat okay with that normal. And I think what's being called for now is a new normal of sorts. We're really, Fannie Lou would say, sick and tired of being sick and tired. When you talk about Dr. King's movement, and when you talk about what we're doing with it, there's a degree of aspirational hope associated with Dr. King, as it was maybe with Barack Obama. But the real questions, the real hard issues, the road to social justice runs through a critical reexamination of some of our most endeared institutions. You have to remember, me being a person of faith, that the church had no problem with slavery. The church had made peace. Indeed, there were slave masters who were pastors. The church had no problem. You saw Dr. King in his letter in the Birmingham jail, dealing with the issues of the faith, of the church, and Jim Crow America. And so when you look at some of these institutions, they have managed to survive. They have managed to thrive in the context of Black death. They have managed to perpetuate themselves in the context of Black death. Black life has really meant very little. We talk about law enforcement, but remember, we have to think a little broader when we talk about Black lives. And so when I think about Dr. King, when I think about bringing people to a place of critical thought, we really want to involve them in that place. And so I'm okay each year in bringing people to a place of contemplation. It's better than them sticking their heads in the sand and thinking that everything is okay. So at least once a year, but this is something different. This is something different.
Professor Haynes, let's go back a couple of days, a couple of weeks. And when you saw the videos of Ahmaud Arbery and George Floyd, what reaction did you have in the moment to seeing those tragedies?
Disbelief, anger, frustration that here another life was being snuffed out. But I think the disbelief was over the callousness of the police in the action, watching people on the side plead with police officers and watching these police officers somehow tune their pleas out and wondering under what conditions do police officers feel that that's okay, that they could get away with such behavior. And I tell you, I can't imagine
that situation reversed for any white citizen, however poor, in America. I couldn't imagine that happening to them.
All right. Professor Toller, likewise, one of the extraordinary things that we've seen has been police officers confronting demonstrators or meeting demonstrators in the street and them taking a knee, like Colin Kaepernick, who just a few short years ago was essentially thrown out of the NFL because of that. What is going on or evolving in America right now that's causing that type of behavior that, frankly, many thought they'd never see?
Yeah, I think that's amazing. And it's not without irony that we do see many law enforcement officials, police and otherwise, joining the protests, taking a knee with protesters, as you mentioned. I think it's important to understand that this moment is capturing much of America in a way that similar moments haven't before. We've recently learned that there have been protests in all 50 states regarding the death of George Floyd and the other deaths of Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor. And so it's a moment that has pulled people in, and the energy and pain around the moment is hard to avoid. But at the same time, we do see that these moments often pass without much structural change. And so we have seen more and more calls from people after the law enforcement agents do take a knee, do join the protesters, to think about what it means to still be part of law enforcement if you have views that are against what you're being asked to do. If you're being asked to pepper spray protesters who are peacefully protesting and you disagree with that, what does that mean for the structure of law enforcement in this country? And how can we continue to push beyond the simple symbolic action of taking a knee, an action that Colin Kaepernick was ostracized for and essentially, essentially blackballed from the NFL for, to actually consider considering real structural change that can affect the systems of inequity in this country.
Professor Toller, another noteworthy aspect of the demonstrations going on throughout the country and the world is they're extremely diverse. And historically, in advocating for Black lives mattering and Black issues being addressed, these would be wholly African-American crowds and oftentimes a bit older than what we're seeing on the streets and in the parks across the country and around the world. What does that composition of demonstrators tell us also about the moment we're in?
I think there's two important things to note on your comment there. First, the way that the Black Lives Matter movement has organized and has demonstrated over the last 7-8 years, really since the killing of Trayvon Martin, has been different than historical movements in that the use of social media has been astounding. And we've really seen younger Black women really leading this movement in ways that have never been done before. And so I think the diversity of age within the movement is in many ways due to a new technological age within social movement advocacy here. I am hopeful, though, that the diversity, especially the racial and ethnic diversity within the movement, is a sign of actual change being warranted. It really took a good 15, 20 years of African-American civil rights struggle prior to the 1960s before the rest of the country caught on and we start to see diverse movements of white liberals and other groups joining with African-American protesters across the country. And it's at that point when we start to see the presidents and the politicians at the national level really paying attention to the movement. And so I'm very hopeful that this might be that moment now where we have built a large enough coalition that the crisis at hand can no longer be ignored.
And I want to say for the record, you referenced the fact that Black women have really been leaders in this movement. And we have 4 Black men on this show. And just to assure the audience that because of the speed of these events, we put this together very, very quickly. And please rest assured that the voice of Black women will be heard in upcoming episodes. I want to turn, though, Sam, to talking about a more systemic issue in some relationships. What is the relationship between the conversation we're having about these mass demonstrations and protests, the free fall of our economy and growing unemployment, and all of that being an outgrowth of something that didn't even exist 90 days ago, the COVID-19 pandemic? How do all of these things relate to each other?
Well, I mean, I'm sure I'm not the only one. For me, there's an initial thought that I had when all this was happening. We have to remember a little bit before you had the armed protest of kind of the Trumpian white nationalists who are calling for their liberty and freedoms. And the things that most of us were thinking about was them spreading this COVID, right?
Are you, and you're referring to situations like walking into the Michigan State Capitol with semi-automatic weapons and rifles.
Right. And it was not just there. I mean, it was pretty ubiquitous all over. And the sentiment, if not, it's all over. But if you look at the video and you of George being his life being snuffed out, and you think about the irony of Colin Kaepernick taking a knee, and you think about the idea that here's one white nationalist cop undercover making a sacrificial killing, if you will, and almost posed. He's almost posing with his hand in his pocket, smiling almost before the camera, in a Colin Kaepernick taking knee kind of posturing as he kills this man. And I think 99 more of those embedded very white nationalists, this is my long game scenario, as they embedded themselves in very righteous protest movements all across the nation in a kind of, how do we take this movement and delegitimize it? And there's plenty of information, stories, indeed pictures of people destroying buildings, creating chaos out of this movement. Black people, people of conscience, coming to protest the killing of this man. Hundreds of thousands coming out. And then at some point, the reality of COVID-19 and the disproportionality of that disease on black and brown bodies. Those people who are out there protesting righteously, after this movement's over, taking their bodies back into their cities, their communities, their homes, taking that COVID back into their communities. I'm afraid of the next 14 to 30 days, what that will really mean. I sometimes think that if someone really wanted to kill black life, they didn't count on white life and other life coming out, but if they really wanted to take black life, they would do something like this very publicly, knowing that black people would come out and protest, catch this COVID and take it back in to their homes. And now that there's 100,000 dead, there's going to be 200,000 or 300,000 dead. My prayer is that something supernatural will intervene between those people going into the community and coming back home and taking that COVID into their mothers and fathers and sisters, into the homes. That's my fear. And that narrative is what I call the long game, is something really sadistic. But in this time, I can only hope and pray that that is not the scenario, that that is not the intent.
Professor Haynes, the same question that I posed to Sam. We've got COVID-19, unemployment at the largest level since the Great Depression. And it, there's a sense that between the healthcare realities and the economic realities, we're in a free fall. And all of this is happening at the moment that this, these spontaneous protests and demonstrations are taking place. What do you think it means?
Well, you know, as Sam said, I think this is an opportunity that can go sour, but it's also an opportunity for change. It's an opportunity for us to recognize some of the things that this virus has revealed, for example. So it's laid bare not only that Black and brown workers are the frontline workers, and it's also laid bare that Black and brown people are the people with some of the preconditions that make us most susceptible to getting COVID. But also, when if we look just a little bit deeper, we'll see that segregation is in part at the heart of the way in which both neighborhoods and health and jobs are distributed across our country. And right now, you could argue that the conservative forces are trying to exacerbate that divide, that spatial divide, and that class divide that's reflected in our neighborhoods. And so on the one hand, I'm very fearful with this authoritarian president. On the other hand, I'm very hopeful because people are beginning to recognize that the violence perpetrated against Mr. Floyd and other Black individuals is tied to the labor exploitation and the lack of valuing Black lives in all these other institutional domains that have been mentioned.
Okay. Professor Toller, I'd ask you to weigh in as well. The relationship between the events of the past few days, the economic conditions, and COVID-19.
I absolutely think that the disparities that COVID-19 has brought to light within the health, within our healthcare system, within our economic system, within our segregated housing system, have propelled this movement in a way that it might not have otherwise been seen. We saw that the country almost went to an entire pause in the wake of COVID, trying to social distance and stop the spread of the virus. However, the one thing that never paused was racism. And as the country slowly opened up, it seemed almost immediately there were incidents of Black lives being taken again and again and again. And the three most prominent incidents that led to these protests, I believe, were driven in part by the knowledge that we are already dealing with a COVID-19 disease that is disproportionately infecting and killing Black people. And now Black people are also having to deal with disproportionate levels of death due to racism as well. And so I think moving forward, the governors, the politicians that have expressed desire to protect Black lives, that have stood with the protesters, have a duty to do whatever they can to prepare for a second wave that we already know will disproportionately hit the Black community hard, and to make sure that there is PPE, to make sure that there are ventilators, that there's hospital space, that there's testing within Black communities that there wasn't in the first wave of this virus, in preparation to protect Black lives, as many has promised to do in the wake of these protests, as COVID most likely continues to spread.
I want to come back to the Professor Fowler, your statement about the presence of racism. And a couple times throughout the show, I think all of you have referred to the current political conditions, and in particular, this administration and our current president. Those who support the current administration president say, well, wait a minute. He passed criminal justice reform that Barack Obama didn't. We had before COVID-19, the lowest level of Black unemployment and Latino unemployment in the history of statistics taken in the United States. And that frankly, that those two things did more to address the underlying conditions of what is at the heart of some of the structural issues and inequities than others have. How do you respond to that? That as a matter of fact, that up until recently, that people who support this administration, this president, think things are going in the right direction, or thought things were going in the right direction with regards to the treatment of African Americans and other people of color and the disadvantaged in this country.
Yeah, I think those arguments have become more and more prominent in society, in American politics, as President Trump's presidency has continued, and he's continued to speak in ways that support potential opposition to racial progress, but supporters have not wanted to acknowledge that that might actually be a reality. And so there's a lot of research that suggests the economic prosperity in the last 2 to 3 years was due to the political moves of the Obama administration following the recession of 2008 and 2009. And the unemployment numbers also seem to reflect different types of employment for different groups, where the wealth gap within American society between Blacks and whites has continued to grow. And although unemployment might be higher than ever within the Black community prior to the COVID outbreak, many African Americans were employed working 2 to 3 jobs just trying to make ends meet instead of actually having a sustainable career and not able to make enough money to save. And so these arguments at face value really don't hold up. Not to mention there are more than enough other incidents of the president and his administration supporting politics and policies that seem to juxtaposition this sort of racial progress, this sentiment towards racial progress, things such as travel bans and FBI files released that suggest there's a target of Black identity extremists. So the evidence is mounting in the other way. And more to the point, right, the action has shown that whenever there is an incident of racial violence, the president has taken much longer to speak up and to support those that were affected and the victims of that violence than any other group or anyone that is protesting or trying to exert their rights, such as the white nationalists protesting in arms across state capitals.
And it's good on both sides. It's folly to think that, you know, you ask yourself, what did he do to create Black economic prosperity? What did he do? What did he put in place? And when you answer those questions, you find, this is a master of gaslighting, such as we've never seen before. But there's hope. And let me just say, before, when it's darkest out, you can look at America. You can look at from Haiti, Saint-Domingue, and when it was dark, there's the freedom of the people that led to the whole America expanding twofold. You look at the Black folks were not sad when there was the American Revolution. They were happy about this notion of American Revolution. Now the colonists weren't, but for Black folks that meant the possibility of freedom. And when you look at the Civil War, we knew what was coming. We knew that 600,000 had to die. But Douglass and everybody understood that what was a sad time for the normal, for the majority, was an opportunity for these people who believe in freedom. I was a preteen in the 60s, and I remember the visceral fear of death. I remember that. I lived on the outside of the Jim Crow, but I remember when I had fear no more. I remember when most of my white friends saw the 60s, and I'll make the point. I remember when they saw the 60s as a time of great struggle and crisis. You know, everybody's hands were up. We saw it as a time of revolution. The music was sweet. And so what I'm saying here, that this is a crisis for those who want to come back to the normal. This is
and what would you say, Sam, it is in one sentence that it is for those who don't?
The Day of Jubilee is very close.
And Professor Haynes, we're going to give you the last word. Out of all that you've seen, what is the most hopeful moment that you've witnessed thus far out of the past several days?
The most hopeful moment. I guess it's the numbers of average Americans who I think might have said America is colorblind because we elected Barack Obama, or you know, this thing with Kaepernick is really not their issue, it's really not a big deal, who now suddenly are out protesting because they've suddenly had a recognition of the severity of racial animosity in this country. And that to me is hopeful, that we don't go back to business as usual, that we break this cycle, because this is a cycle of Black death and Black protest and then complacency and then another Black death and then more Black protest and more complacency. But I, for one, happen to believe that, you know, until we start seeing, you know, white lives attacked by police, as we've been witnessing over the past few days, that's what moves the nation, unfortunately. It's not the killing of Black lives that seems to drive the bus, so to speak. It's when white liberals are willing to put their bodies on the front lines that the rest of America is willing to suddenly treat the topic with its with the gravity that it deserves. So, and in part, that's a reflection of the lack of value of Black lives. And so, you know, there's still a lot of work that we're going to have to do, but there's immediate work to do, and then there's long-term work to do.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks to our guests, and thanks to you for watching Studio Sacramento. See you next time, right here on KVIE.
Thank you for listening to Studio Sacramento from KVIE Public Television. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes to help others find it.
All episodes of Studio Sacramento, along with other KVIE programs, are available to watch online at kvie.org/video.